We can get started. We're on our last class. The final class of this course, Easy Habits for Happiness, part of our Balancing Emotions series of courses. And it just feels like an epic journey that we've been through, maybe because it's been online and because world events and everything that have happened. So let's have a quick look at what we've already covered. Just recently we've been going through the 10-point checklist, what to practice, what to avoid, based on avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions and then putting in place the positive aspect instead. So not leaving a vacuum, not saying just don't do that, but what do we do instead so that we can use the momentum of our actions and our habits to actually create positive habits. So they're called the 10 non-virtuous actions, and it's not a judgmental term. Non-virtuous just means anything that brings suffering, especially long-term suffering to the mind. So some non-virtuous actions might bring a temporary relief or temporary pleasure or happiness, but it doesn't last and it can often compound the problem. So a virtue is anything that brings long-term happiness. We've looked at the activities of the mind. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. So this is a quote from the Buddha. So the other thing, so then communication, our communication traits, how we communicate with others, but also our inner self-talk, our inner dialogue and commentary that's always going on there under the surface, bubbling away. And often we first become aware of it, say, for instance, when we sit down to meditate and all the distractions come in, and then we become aware of that inner tone. And it's not necessarily encouraging and full of wisdom, is it? It can often be quite denigrating and quite focused on the negative. And so that inner self-talk frames our world and makes our world so that it colours everything and means that we really get stuck in a rut. Were there any comments or questions or anything from last week about communication? I know I didn't get to put the sound file, the catch-up sound file or the meditation up. They'll both arrive this week. I'm just really late with everything, what with all of the world events and things. But did you have any questions or anything that came up from last week?
Can I say something?
Yes, yes.
I went out with some, I mean, obviously I talked during the week, but I went out with some friends for coffee. We spoke, we chatted for about 3 hours, and I was just quite aware of, you know, as I've been kind of sharing, I'm becoming more and more aware of, like, sometimes I will just catch myself say a little lie, silly, not even necessary, and then I'd have to backtrack and say, oh, no, I mean, but, you know, it's quite astounding, yeah.
That is brilliant that you recognise that, because we do that all the time, countless little white lies, and then it just, like you said, it just comes, you're not even planning it, and it's just kind of easy to do, but then there's a part of you, what we'd call your discriminating awareness or discriminating wisdom, that becomes aware, oh, hang on a second, that wasn't quite accurate, or that was a little white lie. And so then you become clearer or more specific or backtrack. So you've got kind of two things. One's going just the ordinary momentum that we're not usually aware of. And then the other one, your wisdom, your discriminating wisdom, actually coming in to do something beneficial instead of coming in to be highly critical or judgmental. So it's a good thing to have noticed. And the amazing thing about that, if you do clean up your act with the little inconsequential things like that, it develops its own momentum and it will have huge, fantastic effects on the rest of your speech. So the result is actually far bigger than we could normally anticipate. It'll mean that your thinking will get more focused and clearer. You'll be able to understand finer points. You'll be able to tell when someone else is lying. All of these things, the flow and effects are really big. So it's worth it. It's worth keeping on going. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I noticed that a lot just of how I just, and it's always for me at least, it's always to save face. I'll just want to smooth it over a bit that I'll go, no, I just got to suck it up and just admit.
Yeah.
Courtney, you had something too?
Yeah, I've noticed that it's not that I'm a hateful person or anything, but just a lot of times if I don't like someone's behavior, I'll be like, oh, they're a bit of an idiot, or God, that stupid person. Like every time I've done that, I've like started to catch it and be like, no, their behavior was stupid. They, you know, just I don't like their behavior.
It was fantastic.
I do it like all the time, like especially I've been watching Married at First Sight, which is, it's really hard to be a Buddhist and watch Married at First Sight. Really difficult.
You're a braver woman than me.
Yeah. But yeah, like I've been like trying to like kind of noticing that I do that a lot when I watch that. So kind of like remembering when I'm watching that, or yeah.
Yes. So with that one, that internal dialogue, so part of it is motivated by pride, which sorts the room out and sorts out those people are clearly worse than me, so therefore I feel better about myself as a human being. So a lot of that, you know, that's why we look at car crashes and we feel better. We want to look, and then we go, oh, I'm so glad it wasn't me.
Oh, or
we
look
at other people's disastrous lives, and it's so juicy and it makes us feel better about our life. So that's with the pride side of things. But that the commentary that goes on in the back of our mind there is actually a subtle form of aggression, because it's retaliating. So someone does something that's hurtful or harmful or embarrassing or makes us feel aversion, and we just like throw it back verbally by going, oh, what an idiot, or oh, you know, I can't believe they did that, or all of those things. And what it does is it shuts us off, that we don't have to feel their pain, suffering, embarrassment, whatever.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
If you took some time to set your motivation, go, okay, I'm going to watch maths, and I'm going to watch with an altruistic attitude, and I'm going to everything is going to bring my wisdom and compassion to the fore, and whatever ridiculous things they do, I'm going to be able to notice them in myself to a greater or lesser degree.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take all their suffering off them, and I'm going to give them everything that they need.
Okay. That sounds good. It'll be a good practice, I think.
But give that a go. And then when you find yourself about to fall off the wagon, then put it on mute and regroup, so that you don't fall it back into the.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, thank you.
Okie dokie. So I think you're very brave. Okay, so there, the worksheets and things, our reflections. Today, though, what we're looking at is how to represent. Yo, represent. So to put it into context, taming our mind, well, that's always a challenge. What goes on in our mind, thank goodness, you know, people can't hear what's going on in our mind. That's an ongoing project. Disciplining our speech, it does take effort, but it is possible to do. Even if the mind is going crazy, we can watch our speech. But actually, it's very easy to clean up our life by restraining our physical activities. This is the easy place to start. That's why I've left the easy one to last, the easy bit. So what we'll have a look, we'll just do a little meditation just to focus our mind, and the questions that we're going to ask ourselves, what are the destructive behaviours that we already do, physical behaviours that harm ourselves or others? And probably some will come to mind. And then the other question, what do they stop you doing? That you'd like to be doing, what would you like to be doing instead? So let's just take a moment to settle our posture. So the even our posture should be a nice balance between putting some effort into sitting straight or sitting in a position that's alert, but also open and relaxed. So there's a balance there. So you try and make your spine fairly straight and feel that thread of light running through the center of your body and out the crown of your head, and how it just naturally straightens your spine. Your posture just naturally adjusts around this thread of light. Maybe with each in-breath, for just a few in-breaths, feel your posture become straighter and more alert. And then once your posture and your back is fairly straight, then let the rest of your body relax, and in particular, let your shoulders drop. Release any tension from the jaw, the neck, the shoulders, the arms. Let the hands just relax in your lap. Become present in the room. Notice the physical sensations, maybe the air temperature, if there's a breeze or not, the sensations of the clothes on your skin, of the seat, the rising and falling of your chest or abdomen when you're breathing. If there's any areas of discomfort in your body, then just breathe into them, breathe into it. And as you do, let that part of your body relax. You might become aware of a lot of internal dialogue, the hubbub and bubbub, the echoes of conversations of the day. So just let the conversation subside. No need to get involved. You might also become aware of the emotional tone. So without being completely overwhelmed by it, just notice your energy levels, recognizing that you're not reducible to any one thought or feeling or emotion or even tiredness. They all come and go. They're not you. Just keep settling into the breath with a growing sense of peacefulness. Notice what passes through the mind. Let it arise and let it go. And out of this sense of spaciousness, as you're beginning to relax, then just bring to mind, what are those physical behaviors or activities that you know aren't beneficial or healthy for you or for others? And just have them there. In your mind, that as we go through the class, you'll be able to apply everything right to our immediate human situation. And then recognizing that a lot of our negative behaviors may not be obviously harmful, but they take us away from doing really positive things, from what really matters to us, what's important. So what are those things that we've been neglecting? And then extending our motivation even further by recognizing that we are embodied beings and that what we do in the world affects us and it affects others. So we can adjust our motivation, that we can make the very most of this and bring the most benefit to ourselves and others. That we don't put any limit on that, that we can become the very best that a human being can become, all the way to liberation and enlightenment, just like the Buddha did, we can too. And so in this way, we can make a determination that everything that we reflect on and learn about in tonight's class can contribute to global peace and harmony right now, and long-term peace and happiness and liberation of all sentient beings. So with this, you can gently bring your focus back to the room and we can dive into our topic. So we've been looking at the non-virtuous behaviours and then what we can do in their place. So the non-virtuous physical actions. And I was just looking at this picture, actually. I think it's a great photo because I don't know about you, but I see two things here. I see aggression, but I also see hurt. And they're all mixed up together. And that's pretty much what happens when we're hurt and we can't bear it. We seek to retaliate and show it as aggression. The non-virtuous physical actions are not just the obvious ones of aggression and violence, but they bring us difficulties, both physically but also for the rest of our life, long-term harm or suffering. And it includes not just aggression to others, aggression to, you know, your pets, to other people, but it includes also aggression to things and self-harm, aggression to oneself, being self-destructive. Because oneself is a sentient being too. So the very worst physical actions are killing, taking the lives of others, stealing, and sexual misconduct. And thank goodness, luckily, we probably avoid all of these already. And at least I know in my life partly why I've been able to avoid these, though I haven't avoided all of them, I can assure you, is that our culture supports us. So in other parts of the world, there's very little choice. So when I first look at these, I think, oh, okay, well, I haven't killed anybody. I don't steal other people's stuff and I'm not having any affairs. So I haven't engaged in killing, stealing or sexual misconduct. But actually, a lot of why that is because I haven't had the opportunity or I haven't been forced into it. So, for instance, what do we do if we're in Ukraine? What do we do? How do we look after our own people without killing others, without inflicting the same harm onto others that they're inflicting onto us? So it's a much more difficult situation. Or if you're in a country where you're conscripted, or if you're somewhere where you're so poor that you have to steal food to live, and then you're constantly in fear of being caught, of ending up somewhere worse. And karmically, of course, then it has its ramifications as well. So a lot of how come we're able to be peaceful people is because our circumstances allow us. And I find that quite profound, actually, because then I think, well, what if I was in a different situation? How would I be acting? Would I be all moral? I don't know. How do we know our own measure? How do we know we're not just on default because it's easy? So let's have a look at how we can bring the avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions, bring it to consciousness. So it's not just an accidental thing. You know, we're not just not being violent because the opportunity hasn't presented itself, but where even though our circumstances are relatively peaceful, we're bringing a consciousness and an intention to it, then it becomes very powerful and it actually becomes something that supports us. And then that way we gain confidence in ourselves, that whatever situation we're in, we trust ourselves. We know how we're going to react. We know how we can help others. So the first one, avoiding killing. So what do we abandon here? We abandon murdering others. We abandon abortion. We abandon torture and aggression, violence towards others, including more subtle forms like physical intimidation. So what makes something a negative action, like, for instance, a violent action, isn't necessarily the action, but it's the motivation. So everything comes in a context here. So normally you'd think, say, for instance, slapping a child, that's a violent act and it has long-term repercussions. But if a child's about to put their hand into the fire and you slap the hand away, it's a difference, isn't it? So we can see the difference is there in the motivation. There's one is like real concern to just save them. And the other is an expression of frustration, you know, like when people shake their babies or when they, you know, get violent as retaliation. There's quite a big difference there. So again, we've got to look at the context. The other thing too that we've got to look at with the physical things is, for instance, things like really self-destructive activities, like drinking or taking drugs, and also activities like having an abortion. One thing is to refrain from those. Then the other is to legislate against them, to criminalize them. So don't think that I'm saying we should, you know, criminalize abortion or criminalize drugs or alcohol or anything like that. No, no, no. I'm saying this is a personal thing to do with our own behavior. And actually, if we do, like we've seen what happened when they criminalized drinking alcohol, what happened? A whole lot of underground alcohol speakeasies, a roaring trade in alcohol, like drinking went through the roof. It didn't stop anybody drinking. It just meant there was no way to control it. So the same thing with anything, when you criminalize a negative behavior, you've got to be really careful. It's got to be in the context. So I found, you know, as a Buddhist, it can seem a bit counterintuitive that to save lives, what the most pragmatic thing to do is to legalize abortion. But that's a nuanced argument, isn't it? It doesn't play well in the news. But actually, again, it comes down to what's the motivation, what's the least harm and the most benefit for others. So right here we thought we're in something really obvious. Well, I haven't killed anybody, and we're already way deep into, like, how do we set up our civilized world? Other things to do with physical actions to abandon is to do in terms of violence and intimidation. So the difference between aggression and being assertive. And what I found a lot with guys, for instance, that guys are very rarely taught how to be assertive, that the only way that they can actually express themselves strongly is with violence and intimidation. So the expression and the violence are bound together. It's just such a toxic combination. So the relief of expressing yourself, expressing your frustration, gets hardwired in your brain with violence until it's the only way to get relief. And this really comes from a lack of education, a lack of educating boys in particular of how to deal with all of that frustration in a constructive way. So what to practice instead? Well, abandon those things. Actually, just put a lid on it. And if you're about to explode and you're about to actually express yourself violently, it's best to just leave because you can't undo those things. And then when you've cooled down, what to practice instead? How to fill the vacuum and start supporting positive behavior? Saving lives, protecting the vulnerable, standing up for the vulnerable, donating to charities, joining the Mud Army, help others improve their physical situation, their physical well-being. Anything to help people live better physical lives, healthier lives, longer lives. So there's a whole lot of things that we can do. We can, all the way from just saving the insects in your house and chucking them outside instead of squishing them, sponsoring orphanages, donating blood, giving to wildlife sanctuaries, foster caring for animals, you know, all of these things. There's so many ways, so well set up in our society to be able to protect the vulnerable and save lives. Literally, it's extraordinary. We can just find the one that suits us the best, and then it becomes a positive practice. Help to enhance the physical well-being of those around you. So helping little old ladies carrying their shopping, giving someone a foot massage or a head massage or washing their hair for them, driving people around if they're pedestrians, giving someone a hug when they need it, all of those things. And the benefits. So the long-term benefits for us is that we have a long life without illness and we're born with an intuitive sense of kindness. We have an appreciation of life from an early age. So, you know, karmically, from a Buddhist point of view, you know, how come some little kitties just bring home all the wounded animals and say, "Mummy, mummy, we've got to help them," and other kitties love stomping around on snails? So that comes from what we've been habituated with in the past. You know, we don't come as a blank slate. We come with everything from the past, and then it has its own momentum. But it doesn't mean we can't change it. What we need is mind education. That's what His Holiness the Dalai Lama said all the time. We need to educate ourselves. So, you know, don't have to get judgmental about people or those bad people or those bad kitties, but actually how do we be assertive and save others without being violent, without intimidation, without aggression? I mean, I've said some a little controversial things already.
Yeah, as you mentioned that, abortion is a bit controversial in my mind. Yeah,
it is. It's huge. So what's the thing that's sticking or that's not sticking well?
Well, I suppose, you know, I mean, this is just my point of view, you know, I guess, you know, a woman, I feel a woman should have a choice. You know.
Yeah. That's right. And so then you look under that, and why should a woman have a choice?
Because of, you know, the circumstances in which she's in, or, you know, it might not be favorable for a child, or, you know, many different circumstances.
Yeah, so that's to benefit and to alleviate harm, isn't it?
Mm.
So we've got to look under what guides it is the motivation. So the motivation is always to benefit as much as possible. And if you can't benefit, then to not harm. And so that includes everybody. That includes the baby and the woman and the society. And so then the way that we actually act has to be quite nuanced. But how do we figure it out? It's to do with the situation, with each situation. And how do we figure it out as a society? Well, I'm with you. I think as a society, we've got to legislate in a very pragmatic way, because you can change people's behavior, but you can't force people's morals. So you can't legislate people to be good people. All you can do is direct them in a way that has the least harm. And I mean, a similar thing like this is like with the shooting up galleries for drug taking, you know. So actually, if you have a gallery where people can go and take drugs in a safe environment and they've got all of the sanitizers and everything like that, actually deaths go down and drug use goes down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you look at it, it's counterintuitive, and you think, oh, you're supporting drug taking. But actually, no. But it's such a difficult thing to sell to the community over and over and over again. And it's the same thing with abortion. If you legislate a woman's right to choose and you have education, the actual incidence of abortions goes all the way down.
Really? Have you?
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have where it's illegal. Usually where it's illegal, you also don't have sex education. Then you have all the underground scurrilous people taking advantage of the vulnerable, heaps of money. Then you have people that are shooting other people, all of these things. The incidence of violence goes all the way up.
Mm.
So.
And women can die, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then standard of life goes down, all sorts of things. So there is a discrepancy in how we legislate and the results that we want. So what we're looking at here is the real inner story. What we ourselves seek to do is to avoid harm and enhance the lives of others to the very, very, very best that she can. But everything in Buddhism is about the middle way. So, for instance, you know, His Holiness, when he's talked about being vegetarian, so he did this wonderful way of how to be pragmatic in the world, that it's always an individual choice, but institutions can show the way. So what he did was he asked all the major monasteries to, were in their kitchen, to go vegetarian, even though culturally it's never been vegetarian. So the canteen where they feed 1,000-2,000 monks, it's all vegetarian, but the monks are allowed to cook in their own rooms and they can cook whatever they want. It's up to them. It's very skillful, isn't it? Yes, okie dokie. So that's the one, you know, with avoiding killing, by and large, we can do this, and we have so many options, other things that we can do where we do not have to resort to actually killing other human beings. And not only that, you know, we've got it all set up that we can give blood and platelets and things that actually save lives, you know, put ourselves on the organ donor list, all of those things. Even if all your organs, like my organs, are probably ruined, right? But, you know, if you've got really nice hair, you can donate your hair. You can grow a beard and then shave it off in November and raise money. There's all sorts of ways that we can use our body to save lives and protect the vulnerable. And it's really energizing for us when we do. All right, the next one, avoiding stealing. So what to abandon? Abandon stealing things that are owned by either individuals or groups. So it means don't take stuff from individual people, from your neighbours or your flatmates. Also don't steal stuff from work or from the country. So that includes things like cheating on your taxes, late payment of bills, which is kind of like stealing time. Or borrowing with no intention to return. It also includes getting other people to take stuff for you. Often our sense of morality is, are we going to get caught or not? So if we look around and there's no one around, we'll take it. If there's someone around, oh, okay, we won't take it. So that's our sense of ethics is determined by our circumstances. So this is like, would we take it if no one saw us? You know, even if we're going to get away with it, are we still going to take it or not? So it's worth just having a look. I mean, I look at my own life and I think, okay, most of it is an external sense of ethics about whether I'm going to get caught by the police or not. But how much of it is actually from my own sense, my own innate feeling of what's right or wrong, which we have. We think of it as our sense of fairness. You know, it is there innate in us, this sense of balance. But how much do we listen to it or not? What to practice instead? Of course, practicing generosity. But it, again, generosity doesn't mean giving all your stuff away. It's because it's not about the stuff. It's about our intention. So definitely you've got to give according to your means. Don't be kind of foolhardy and, you know, take your super out and give it to everybody and then have nothing to live on in the future. Give what you can comfortably give. But what they say is to give a small amount many, many times so that it becomes a habit. You get used to it. It becomes your modus operandi. Every day you give something away. Every day you release something. You practice generosity. You help others with what you have. So there are many things that we can give, not just stuff as well. We can give our time. What do they say? Time is money. So if you've got no money, give your time. It counts. And really think of it as you are practicing generosity, that open-heartedness and big-heartedness where you go, okay, even though this person annoys me a little bit, I'm going to give them 20 minutes of my unadulterated attention and whatever they need, I'm there for them. That's an act of generosity. And isn't it amazing when someone does that to us, when they give us their undivided attention, when we know they're there for us, it makes a huge difference. Giving comfort, encouragement, case in point, the Mud Army. So, you know, the Mud Army in Brisbane has been, we had one of our students this morning say they signed up for the afternoon shift, and so by the time they got there, just about everything was done already by the morning people. And they're walking up and down the road, can I help, can I help? And they're going, no, we're fine. Until they finally found this guy that he said, oh, well, if you could help clean my fence and all the rubbish off the fence. And they're like, oh, thank you, finally we've got something to do. And he's going, thank you, what do you mean? And Anthony's saying, oh, well, thanks for giving us the opportunity to help you. And he's like, what? So, you know, there's so many ways that we can give. Try and whatever that you give, it's to do with what you physically can do comfortably, and then just stretch it a tiny bit, not a huge amount. Because one of the worst things is regretting it later, thinking, oh, really, I shouldn't have given away all my paycheck because now what am I going to do? Now I'm in trouble with my family. So it's better to just have the momentum of giving every day, even if it's just a small amount, and never regretting it. Then, so the different types of resources. Of generosity, sharing our resources and material aid, things, stuff. Also, generosity of providing safety, solace, comfort. And the third type of generosity is giving education. You know, that's the really big one, to helping others help themselves. So educating others in nonviolence, educating others in how to prepare for a flood, educating others in how to back up your computer, educating others in Dharma advice, sharing what you learn on this course, that kind of thing is an act of generosity. So the benefits of this, of not just avoiding stealing, but what to practice in instead, generosity. The benefits is that it just seems that material wealth comes easily. that you have enough resources, that even when things go wrong, people show up with help, with a pot of soup. Complete strangers help you. So instead of being very tight and always worrying, will I have enough, worrying about resources, the result of practicing generosity and this attitude and habit of every day giving something away means that you, internally, psychologically, you relax, and then you've created space for people to help you. You actually let others help you. So then things come easily, and you always find yourself with the help that you need. So questions or comments about this one, stealing or the generosity, what to do in its place? What else? Okay, so then, this is where MAFS comes in. M-A-F-S, married at first sight. I've got to say, the only thing that I can have been able to watch of that is the ad. I can't even watch the show. So this one, the avoiding sexual misconduct. So what is sexual misconduct? What is it that we're actually abandoning? Well, the really obvious one, cheating on your partner or cheating with someone else's partner. That's it. So having an affair with someone else's partner or cheating on your own. That's by and large the main one. And even though we all know that it's wrong, that it hurts others, we're so driven by the mind of attachment that we just put that aside. We just want what we want. And then later on, the whole catastrophe, the results come along, and it's just terrible for everybody. So this is something that we know it's not right, and yet countless movies are made of it, countless TV shows, happens all the time. There are other forms of sexual misconduct, though, abuse, coercion, and exploitation. So the sexual abuse comes under the misconduct. It's also, it's kind of motivated by both hatred, distaste, aversion, and attachment. So sexual misconduct can be things like touching others without their consent. So not, you know, of course, there's things like to avoid rape, but the whole thing of just people invading your personal space at work and touching you up or touching your shoulder or touching your arm or touching the small of your back that just creeps me out, that's all sexual misconduct. And isn't that a problem in our society? I mean, you know, you'd think in this day and age that it wouldn't, but it happens all the time. We need so much education about this. Coercion, exploitation, and a lot of this comes from being blind about our own power. So if you're, usually if you're a guy, you have a bit more power in the workplace, and so you can be completely oblivious to the imbalance of power and how if a guy touches a woman, it's totally different than if a woman touches a guy, because it's not a level playing field. And so many guys don't know this, they're completely oblivious, and it come from a whole generation upon generation of culture of being oblivious to it. So, you know, from my side, I'd rather know. I'm terrified about what I'm oblivious about, you know, that kind of sense of entitlement. And I've had friends, pardon me, that have come from quite misogynistic cultures and have been really sexist. And but because they've been my friends, I've kind of said to them, you know, that's not acceptable behavior with a woman. You can't touch a woman like that. You actually can't do it. They're going like, why? It doesn't mean anything. Yes, it does mean something. And because they were my friend, I was able to explain it. They're like, what? I didn't know it was like that for you guys. I didn't know it was like that for a woman that you're scared all the time walking around at night. Like, what? They had no idea. So much of it is education. And again, And once we can do that, then you stop hating the person and hate the behavior. And the behavior harms them as much as it harms me, is the other thing. What I found really amazing, though, apart from Married at First Sight and all of the, you know, the behind the scenes and the betrayals and the cheating, you remember that there was an ad on TV for Ashley Martin? I think they might have gone out of business. So Ashley Martin was like a dating site, and the tagline was life is short, have an affair. So it was actually set up how you can cheat on your partner. So all of this is an expression of our culture. It's not like this is an aberration. This is a result of our culture, which shows how toxic it is underneath. So, of course, what happened with Ashley Martin was that someone hacked into the database of a whole lot of people that have been on Ashley Martin and had an affair and made their names public. And then a couple of those people who were quite high standing in the community and their names were made public committed suicide. And then Ashley Martin was sued. So, I mean, the mess and the hurt just like continued like this toxic cloud. Okay, so there's a lot there in sexual misconduct. And so this also why I put this class on last is I used to put this class about physical actions in the middle of the course, you know, start body, then speech, then mind, but no one came back after this class. I'm like, what happened? What happened? Was I too heavy? But what it was, I think, was that a whole lot of people got really embarrassed because we do this. We do engage in sexual misconduct, and then we feel so guilty. We don't like being told that it's wrong or being shown up. So as I put it at the end. And actually, I've got to tell you a story too. So in my misspent youth, you know, I did have quite a lot of affairs, but I made a promise to myself that I wasn't going to hide it. And so, you know, if I got caught out, I'd accept the consequences. And so there was one time where I was having an affair with a married man, and his wife came over and confronted me about it and said, "Are you having an affair?" And I said, "Yes, I am. It's true. But you don't have to worry because I'm not going to take your man away from you. In fact, we kind of talk about you and I'm trying to help you patch up your relationship." Anyway, she was like kind of a bit gobsmacked, but also kind of relieved that I was, you know, we were able to communicate. And, you know, to her credit, she didn't lose the plot. And, you know, we ended up being quite good friends. But, boy, the husband got into big trouble because then she asked him, "Are you having an affair?" And he said no. Anyway, I'm not sure what happened with them. They did stay together though. So that's just fessing it up just so that you feel, okay, you know, we've all been there. Well, maybe you haven't, but, you know, I've been there and done that. And so I know from both sides of the equation, I've also been cheated on. So this is one of those things where we know better, and yet we do it. And that's really tricky, especially if you're an intelligent person. It's really tricky to admit it. So thanks, Tamara. I'm never sure if I should tell my stories or not, if it's too scandalous. But thank you. If it's helpful, then good. Phew. Okay, I'll relax now. So what to do instead? What to practice instead? So the opposite of sexual misconduct is treating others with respect. So really showing respect to others as human beings, giving them the human dignity, respecting their feelings, their personal boundaries, and supporting relationships, helping create harmony. Helping to sustain relationships. So I really like this because it kind of speaks to our best self, doesn't it? To our innate sense of fairness, and respecting fellow human beings. And it takes it away from that sexual objectification, which is what leads to sexual misconduct mostly. Then also protecting the vulnerable, especially the vulnerable from abuse, coercion, exploitation. And that can be quite difficult to stand up for and protect those who are undergoing sexual abuse, to actually even be able to recognize that it's happening, because it's such a reflection on us and our culture that often we can't see it. And to try and change unfair laws. So, you know, like a few years ago when we finally had the whole thing for the marriage equality. So that was a long time coming. And, you know, that even though there's all these logical reasons for it, the slogan that spoke to the most people was vote for love, wasn't it? So this, it was the bigger picture. So it's really important that as a society, we work towards much more fairer laws, fairer legislation. Vote for love. You know, support everybody in our community and try and make sure that the law reflects that, reflects respect for everybody. So, you know, we might have to actually do some lobbying and go to demonstrations and try and educate our aunties and uncles and work colleagues in the very best possible way, you know, from a position of respect. Respect for everybody. Trying to change whatever unfair laws. I mean, other unfair laws in some countries, you know, the age of consent is like 13 years old, you know, so that's not protecting the vulnerable. So really working for the to try and change that in whatever way that we can. And the benefits of treating others with respect on all levels, from the personal, the social, legal, global, the benefits are that we ourselves experience harmonious relationships, that the relationships that we have are long-term, they're sustainable, they last a long time and support us for a long time, and that we are surrounded by friends, that the people who surround us support us. They're not trying to rip us off. They're not intimidating us or antagonistic. They support us in our life. That's the result. So it's quite amazing, isn't it? You know, we want to have harmonious relationships and long-term relationships and have friends, but how do we go about it? At best, usually it's in a haphazard manner. But actually, by treating others with respect and supporting the relationships that are there, really trying, if you have the skills, learning about conflict resolution, bringing up kids to really respect others as human beings, respect animals as living beings, all of that means it's not just being harmonious, but it actually means creating harmony. And if we create harmony, then we have harmonious relationships. So that takes us to how our behavior defines us, our activities, what we do, how we act in the world actually ends up defining how other people react to us, how they think of us as a human being, and that ends up defining us, doesn't it? So generally, we're propelled through life through all of our intentions, whatever they are, whether we set our motivation as an altruistic one, whether we're just running on autopilot, whether we're, you know, motivated by guilt or desire or whatever, urges, attitudes, everything. That propels us through life, and then we act on it. And when we act on it, very quickly it becomes habitual behavior. And that habit, the habitual behavior, develops its own momentum. And very soon, we have no control over that. So we want to make sure that the momentum that we have is a positive one. So, you know, I've seen some documentaries of teachers at a kindergarten, and the way that they, their posture is open, friendly, their tone of voice is friendly, patience is infinite, and they get to practice that every day. Like, that is extraordinary. Then that becomes like second nature. So every day we have to try and embody the things that we value. So I thought what we could do is just quickly go through the destructive ones. We'll probably recognize a few of these in our own life. So destructive physical behavior that ends up defining us as a human being if we get addicted to online gaming, surfing the net, social media, all of these addictive behaviors. So social media is designed exactly like the pokies to psychologically hook us in. They use exactly the same psychology and algorithms. They're all highly, highly addictive. And so this becomes a destructive behavior. Well, online gaming, you know, yeah, you lose all your money, and pokies, you lose your money. But social media, that doesn't seem to have such a negative effect, except what happens. And this is why I threw myself off Facebook several years ago, because it just sucked up too many hours in the day. And I thought, I'm going to die. And all that's happened is I've spent hours on Facebook. Like, I can't withstand this. So I had to throw myself off. So remember, something is destructive, not that it's necessarily just overtly destructive, but it takes you away from positive things. Other destructive behavior, overeating, oversleeping, compulsive sexual activity, too much drink and drugs, substance abuse or dependency. So all of these extremes. So it's over, it's too much, it's over, and then it becomes a habit. So then you have not just the psychological extreme, but then it becomes a physical addiction as well. Two different things that we have to deal with. So the harm is enormous. Other compulsive behavior, shopping, gambling, hoarding. I mean, we've all got hoarding tendencies, but in our society, we have the circumstances that enable it. If we lived in a society where we didn't have any money and hardly any stuff, you wouldn't even notice hoarding tendencies. And in fact, hoarding becomes a benefit because you use everything. But in our society of affluence, it becomes very debilitating. Oh, all the obsessive OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, compulsive email checking, compulsive social media checking, compulsive hand washing, compulsive, you know, you name it. And then the violent or aggressive outbursts and destroying stuff. So this one in particular, like I mentioned before, with aggression, that if the only way that you can experience some kind of relief is by letting out your aggression, this terrible habitual response gets hardwired into your brain, that you hardwire in relief and aggression until the only way that you can get rid of that frustration and angst and despair and anger and all of those things is by harming others. So a lot of domestic abuse comes from this cycle of not knowing how to deal with frustration and hurt. And the only way that it's been shown is by physically expressing it. It's a terrible, terrible cycle for everybody involved. So that kind of behavior ends up defining us. So there is something that we can do instead. We can change the channel, and we can use the momentum of habit to help us instead of destroy us. So before I do that, before I actually give you the answer, positive behavior that can define us, What are some positive or constructive, beneficial things that we can do that can become a habit that are useful, beneficial, enjoyable? What are some things? You know, they're all the negative ones. A lot of those can come to mind. What are some positive ones? Does anyone have anything at all?
Can I say?
Tamara, yes.
It's just pretty basic and just physical, but, you know, like exercise is why, you know.
Yes, exercise, that's right. So exercise helps our body, extends our life, releases the endorphins. I'd never do it personally, but I hear some people do. What else?
It's Courtney here.
It's
just interesting you're saying about oversleeping, because I have chronic fatigue, so I feel I need to sleep a lot sometimes. But in saying that, I think there probably are more positive ways to deal with that than just giving in to sleeping. Like, for instance, things like meditation or gentle exercise, I think, help your fatigue in a more productive way than just giving in and lying in bed all day, which can end up making you feel worse in the end.
It can end up making you feel worse. But Courtney, the other thing you can do is just get better at sleeping. Mm. So, you know, chronic fatigue, pushing yourself really, really doesn't work. And not only do you have chronic fatigue, but then you've got the guilt.
Yeah.
You know, there's the stigma, there's the two things.
Yeah.
To deal with. So one thing is that if you are going to sleep, instead of having it as a compulsion mm-hmm. and then feeling guilty about it, make it something really beneficial. So one of the things, for instance, a thought transformation thing that you can do when you sleep is that when you lie down and you put your head on the pillow, you think, may everyone be able to rest just as I am. May they enjoy the rest of nirvana. May they achieve the lasting peace of nirvana as you put your head down on the pillow.
Okay.
And then you can also think that you put your head down in the Buddha's lap.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. So,
and then the Buddha radiates light and it fills your whole body and your body becomes a body of light mm-hmm. and then you let yourself go to sleep.
So you're getting like better sleep.
Yeah, and you're sleeping in the light rather than compulsively like trying to just block out everything.
Yeah.
You can transform sleep into the path to enlightenment, and especially if you have chronic fatigue. Sleep as much as you can, but make it really good sleep.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Okay, thank you.
Great. Good. What else? Okay, so we've got exercise, sleep. What else? No one said crochet. So me, I love crochet. And one of the reasons, of course, like it's creative, it's portable, it's a nice conversation starter when you don't know how to kind of make a connection with somebody. When you're in a foreign country, if you take out your crochet, everybody relaxes, especially if you've got like pink hair like me, they're like, whoa, who's that person? You take out your crochet, they go, oh, she must be okay. So it's a great skillful means that way. But anything that we do with our hands, repetitive like that, whether it's crochet or, you know, sometimes people say they relieve stress by making cookies or baking bread, kneading the dough. So all of that activity with our hands releases endorphins in our brain. So whether it's playing music, wood carving, knitting, gardening to an extent too, all of this, the repetition has a physiological effect on us as well. And so it sets up this really nice momentum. It's something that we like doing. It's a hobby, so we don't have pressure on ourselves to be perfect. So we relax, doesn't matter if we stuff up. It's a bit social, and physically we're doing gentle exercise, where using our body physically and the endorphins being released in our brain. So taking up a cheap hobby is a really, really good idea, very skillful. And then with just a little bit of a tweak of mind transformation, you can turn it into a profound activity, not just a mundane one, just like, you know, with the sleep. Every time you put your head down, you think, may all beings experience the everlasting peace of nirvana. And then you can think, and by me having this wonderful sleep, may I lead them all there. May I be the one to lead everyone to this state. And put your head in the Buddha's lap. Please, Buddha, help me to do that. All the light comes, you sleep in the light. When you're crocheting, you know, you can think, well, what I think is I'm bringing something out of nothing, out of just a thread, it turns into a thing. And so all the whole time I'm doing that, and may I make something with this thread of my life. May the day-to-day-to-day-to-day-to-day continuum, may it turn into something useful for others. So, you know, just with a little tweak of thinking, these physical activities can become really profound. So the nice, enjoyable things: take a bath, go for a walk, enjoy swimming, go dancing, learn the cha-cha, all of those things. It doesn't just have to be like punishment, oh, I've got to do some exercise and get in shape because I hate the shape of my body. No, it's something that you love doing. So, you know, a couple of our members just went and learned ballroom dancing because they weren't interested in exercise, just like me. I'm not interested in exercise, but they thought, oh, dancing looks fun. I'm pretty hopeless at dancing. I'll go and learn. How brilliant. Hobbies: gardening, crochet, woodwork, cooking, all of those things. The key there is remembering their hobbies, because that way we don't put the pressure on ourselves. Thought transformation on daily chores like cleaning or cooking, doing it for others. So even when you're cleaning, you know, instead of just cleaning, think, may I clean out the suffering. As you're cleaning that saucepan, may I clean out all of my negative habits. Be gone. It's like, out damn spot. As I'm cleaning all the dishes, cleaning the cups and the glasses, may I clean the minds of all sentient beings. May they reveal their innate purity and clarity that's there underneath all the grime. Learning a musical instrument, joining a choir, volunteering. You know, there's that fantastic documentary about the, I think it's called The Choir of Hard Knocks, of homeless people. I think it was in Sydney maybe, or they did a concert at the Sydney Opera House. You know, so all these homeless people, terrible, difficult lifestyle, really, really challenging, very dysfunctional, lots and lots of compounded problems. And yet when they're there practicing in the choir, that was like the highlight of the week. And it's what kept a lot of them going, and so enjoyable. Doesn't matter if you can sing or not. When you're in the choir, it doesn't matter. Or here, if you come to puja and you just sing your heart out, doesn't matter if you can sing or not. It all sounds good in the end anyway, but you have that experience, wonderful experience of it. Meditation, reading, painting, getting a cat, a dog, a fish or a bird, looking after someone else makes all the difference. Looking after the life, the body of someone else. Just one other. Doesn't have to be all sentient beings, just this one right in front of me. Makes all the difference. And then we can think, may I be able to do it for everybody as well. And keeping a journal. So all of this, all of these things, the repetition of these things that are enjoyable, they bring benefit. And then if we bring our mind, our purpose or intention to it, can bring long-term benefit as well. Within a short while, they become a habit, and these things begin defining us. Not just us, but also our relationships. So now, yo, represent. So we're talking about physical actions, the body, how we use our body. So actually, we're not just our body, and we are much more than our body. So this will blow your mind, but I just thought, when, because we're focusing on the body, it's really worth talking about this, because that we can get the whole world here in a microcosm. So we, our body, we're not just our body. Our body represents us, but it's not us. So actually, when we look at our body, and most of the time we're not very, we don't necessarily like the shape of our body or the color of our body or how it works, you know, it's quite critical. We're not very happy about it. But actually, our body is only 8% us anyway. It's not even us. So our body's made up of water, space, other organisms that keep us alive. You know, when we actually look at our body. So we're actually this complex organism, almost like a condominium that we're inhabiting in a way. And actually the ratio of what's our DNA and all the other organisms and everything that keep us alive is 8 to 1. So that's 8 other organisms to 1 cell of ours. So tiny amount. It's actually the kindness of all the little skin mites and everything, the bacteria in our stomach and everything, that keeps us alive and keeps us going and means we don't suffocate and means we can ambulate through the world and make a difference in the world. So it actually is an incredible, harmonious existence. We're supported right now by countless multitudes without even knowing it. And then we have this idea that we are what we look like, but actually what we are, we've got this image that we superimpose on our body. And most of the time the image in our body matches, but sometimes it goes awry. So as you get older, you only discover you get older because you go to do something that you used to be able to do in your youth and you fall over and hurt yourself and you get on funniest home videos. So there's a discrepancy. You have a body image of being young, and it doesn't match with the current body. This can also go wrong in more disastrous ways. For instance, body dysmorphia. Say if you have anorexia. So you have a body that's incredibly skinny, but what you've mapped on top of that body is a fat body. And that's actually what you experience. There's a disconnect. So it's no good just saying, look at yourself in the mirror, you know, you're a skeleton, you can't see it, because what you're relating to is this image of your body, which is completely out of step with reality. So body dysmorphia is a huge thing, and as a medical kind of thing. The other time that it happens is like with phantom limb syndrome, where you might be in an accident and you have one of your limbs amputated, a leg or an arm, but you can still feel it. It's still there. And not only that, it's still hurting. And it's like, you know, what do you do? You can't get rid of a hurting limb that's actually not even there. So that's this body dysmorphia. You know, our body kind of represents us, but it isn't us. There's a lot more going on. And of course, the way that women see themselves is a lot uglier and out of shape than they actually are. And the way guys see themselves, so this is just a cultural thing, is a lot more buff and fit than they actually are. So there's total body dysmorphia there as well. Then not only that, but on the other side of things, we represent. So it's not just us walking down the street, you or me, you know, it's not just Miffy walking down the street. It's a tall white woman walking down the street. And I'm representing whole swathes of society. I'm representing women. You know, if you're in a car and you're driving and you stuff up doing something driving, everyone's going to go, oh, you know, not Miffy's no good driver. They're going to go, women drivers. So what we do, we represent whole swathes of society. If you're a parent, how you are as a mother or a father, your child is going to think that represents all parents, all mothers, all fathers. So how our mother was, how our mother treated us, that's how we think all mothers are. That's how we judge all parents. A teacher represents all teachers. When we have a bad teacher at school, we never think, oh, I got a bad egg. We just think, I hate teachers, isn't it? We just blanket everybody. And, you know, when we're overseas, think back in the time when we're overseas, where it's not just me overseas, it's me as an Australian overseas. So what I do is what people are going to think Australians are like, which may or may not be a good thing, I'm not sure. Closer to home, you know, so, when I go up to Carindale to do the shopping, they know I come from a Buddhist centre because occasionally, of course, when I do the puja shopping for our ceremonies, I'd rock up with a whole shopping trolley full of bananas, soy milk and chocolate. And they like looking at me going, that's a strange diet. So I've often said, oh, it's a special Buddhist day. We're having a, you know, a ceremony. And so these are the offerings. Oh, right. So now all the checkout chicks at Carindale know that I come from the Buddhist center. So whatever I do at that checkout, I have to be very, very good because I represent. So not only do I represent that Buddhist center down the road, I represent all of Buddhism. Isn't it? If I said a cross word to someone, or if I was a bit rude to the checkout, or if I said something, you know, to the person waiting behind me in the queue, you know, like stand back, what about social distancing? All of that would reflect not just on me, but of all of Buddhism across space and time. Like it's a huge thing. So all of us, we represent all the time, and we just don't know it. We don't recognize the power that we have. To animals, we represent humans, isn't it? So how we treat animals, that's how they're going to think of all human beings. You know, we represent. So with this, I mean, it can be terrifying, but it also shows that we have a whole lot of latent power. The fact that we are embodied, that we're physical beings, means that we have this incredible power. So, you know, we've got to use it. We've got to harness that power to be able to supercharge our life and benefit ourselves and others. So we're not just our body, and we are much more than our body. Our body represents us. You know, it's a placeholder. It's only 8% our DNA. The rest is everything else. Bits of atoms from the beginning of the universe, other creatures. We're a combination of consciousness and collaboration. And things can go wrong, and then it's called body dysmorphia. And it's usually only then that we recognize, ah, oh, there is this map that we have on us. We're never actually relating to our physical body. We're relating to that idea of us. Then we represent others. We represent whatever section of society we are, women, white people, old people, mothers, teachers, humans, drivers, neighbors, you name it, that's what we represent. So if we don't use it, we will lose it, and karmically as well. If we don't take this power and use it to live ethically and to benefit others, in the future, we won't have the choice. We'll lose that ability. We'll just be thrown around in circumstances where we don't have a choice to live ethically. We just live hand to mouth, you know, moment to moment under incredible stress. So not just immediately now, use it or lose it, like with our physical strength, you know, you've got to keep on using it, otherwise everything atrophies. It's also deeply within us karmically as well. So comments, questions about this, about being embodied beings? Courtney's typed in, wow. I did see that a little earlier. Anything at all, comments, questions?
If no one's going to jump in.
Tamara.
I'm just going to backtrack a little bit to sexual misconduct.
Yeah, yeah.
It's okay. Sort of relates to body, I guess. But one thing that I realised, you know, because I've been thinking a lot about this last week, and I think for me also that what comes under the banner of that is kind of when, and I think I've done a lot of this, like when I don't communicate to someone that I'm not interested and I just let that string along. You know what I mean? It sort of falls under that and communication. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the thing that, you know, women to keep ourselves safe, it's on us to communicate, whereas actually it should be that we can all just relax and then we can communicate if we want to take it further. But no, we have to communicate, no, I'm not available. So that says a lot about our culture, doesn't it? So, you know, we're not going to be very relaxed or happy. I don't think all cultures are like that. I think there are some cultures where, you know, everyone's taken as nobody's going to hit on anybody else unless you explicitly do it.
Yeah.
Then again, I've been in situations where unless you physically say no, everyone thinks you're up for it. Mm. So it's a real cultural thing. I mean, I'm sure that's why a lot of people wear wedding rings. So I stopped wearing a wedding ring when COVID happened, and it's a bit hard to do all the, you know, sanitizing and things. But wearing a wedding ring is a very good form of armor. Because, you know, it says a lot, and I didn't realize, oh, of course, that's why people do it, because it indicates a status.
Mm-hmm.
and it makes a difference. So yeah, I mean, and there's a, again, we need all of the nuances there, because I had a big disagreement with one of my friends, you know. So I'm on the pragmatic side of things that say, if you go out and you're walking around the middle of the night in the city by yourself, then you wear something kind of to keep you invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a pragmatic thing to do. And then my friend is, no, why should I? We should be able to wear whatever we want to wear, and everybody else can just keep themselves nice, keep their hands to themselves. So one way is you cover yourself up, so that nobody else has to look at you. And the other way is, well, excuse me, you guys, you just go put your own heads in a paper bag. It's actually not my problem, it's your problem.
Mm.
So either side, I think, has real merit. And we've just got to look at what the circumstance is. Mm. To keep you safe and to change society. And it's a real balancing act. And so we need people that are real trailblazers, and we need people that teach you how to be safe. So, you know, I did both. I walk around in with outrageous clothes by myself in the middle of the night, and was pretty fearless about it. But it's also because I grew up in the slum of Fitzroy, so I learned how to be, before Fitzroy was gentrified in Melbourne, I learned how to be safe on the streets, and also because I'm tall and a bit of a giant. And so that kind of, you know, people go, oh, I'm not so sure if I, that's a bit too difficult. and leave me alone. So I've been protected. Again, it's the way that I've been able to negotiate my way through all of this is we've got to get to the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter is that people are imprisoned by their own circumstances, but also by their own entitlement, you know. So in terms of the guys, they are as imprisoned as the women. And so, you know, if you can work for the benefit of everybody, educating everybody, protecting the vulnerable and educating the oppressors, then we can really make some headway. It's a real tricky thing. Thing too, I was pretty guileless in that I never noticed when anyone was flirting with me. I just, you know, talked to people on whatever. And so I never even noticed if anything was happening. Everyone probably just thought I was thick as a brick, right? So that saved me from a lot of that social coding and things because I just don't notice it. Again, I probably got away with it because I was tall. If I had have been petite, I probably would have been taken advantage of, I'd say. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, Courtney, I am a giant, and it's kind of lucky why I have such a silly name, Miffy, you know, because at least the name makes me a little less in stature. And then when I've got tall hair and high heels, then I'm even taller as an effect on others. At the same way, like Venerable Robina, for instance, she's going to be coming to Australia in September this year, and she's such an enormous presence. And, you know, I've mostly just recently, you know, taken teachings from her online. So she just fills the whole room with her personality. I think she's a giant. But when she comes here and she stands up, she comes up to here on me. She's really short. And thank goodness, because if she had have been a giant as well as this huge personality, everyone would have been terrified of her. But, you know, because she's short, then it's okay. So, again, the kind of body that we have, it's all to do with how are we going to use it. Someone else, you know, who I've really admired, Angela Merkel, you know, amazing politician, very pragmatic politician, you know, since retired. But the way she presented herself was a very frumpy lady. And why? Because she was a powerful. And you can't be pretty and powerful, not possible. So she relinquished the pretty. You know, she made sure her shtick was quite conservative, quite frumpy, completely asexual, and that way she could embody her power. So, the way that we actually use our body, it's a tool. It's a tool for getting through this life, and we can harness that power, as well as use our body to create mountains of merit, to benefit others, even in tiny, tiny ways, just by cleaning their fence or carrying their shopping. And it has a huge effect on others. So the worst physical activities that we can all abstain from: killing others, stealing, sexual misconduct. Yes, we can refrain from those. It is easier for us to avoid those than, say, the ones to do with speech and the mind, because largely our culture is a peaceful culture and it supports that, even if there are pockets of incredible, you know, sexual abuse and violence and things. Largely our society supports us. It's going in the right direction. And we can harness this power of being embodied beings to become a positive force in the world, to represent. So I will do a meditation for you and post it online for those of you who got the package. To sum up our whole course, you know, happiness and habits. So, we, you know, remember when we looked at the three types of happiness? Happiness of sensual pleasures, just the general comfort, nice food, nice music, mostly comes from the physical activities. You know, mostly The pleasures of the world comes from physical expression, physical activities, what we get from the world. The happiness that comes from overcoming our disturbing emotions, letting go of our preoccupation with everything, you know, being comfortable and actually having positive relationships. Most of this comes from speech, how we interact with others. The way that we mostly connect with others is through our speech. And not only that, our inner self-talk is also how we describe the world to ourselves, and it makes our world. So this is this one where we have a lot of room to move, where it's mostly to do with what we bring to the world rather than what we can extract from it. And it mostly comes from overcoming our disturbing emotions. And then it leads to the deepest state of happiness, the stages toward awakening, and that's what we become. And this is the one that's mostly associated with the mind. So it's not circumstantial in that it doesn't rely on what other people do to us or what happens to us or how other people talk to us. It's how we respond. It's what we bring from our side. And that comes from working on ourselves and being ethical, being at peace with ourselves, embodying all of our values. And that comes from really working deep within our own mind and being honest and seeing what's going on and bit by bit, you know, being kind, developing ourselves as human beings. So these three, body, speech, and mind, do correlate a lot with these three levels of happiness that we talked about and how we need to incorporate all three. You know, we do need a level of physical comfort, or we're too overwhelmed, you know, like with the floods. It's, you know, life is very, very difficult if you don't have a safe place to live. But what makes a big difference isn't the stuff, is it? It's about human connection and how we contribute. And that way we begin to feel like we are worth something. And all of this, if we continue with that and we continue working on our mind, our heart, our inner life, then we can transform. We can transform our entire experience. We can transform ourselves as human beings all the way into Buddhas, into enlightenment. I have a little reading to sum it up from this great book, you know, I Can Make You Happy by Paul McKenna, and I've been reading a bit from this every now and again. So this is what he says. Being happy is simple. Being unhappy is complicated. Happiness teaches us that deep down we are already connected to each other, and it reminds us to enjoy that. Happiness reminds us that every day is precious. Not one day of our lives will be repeated. Each day we can choose happiness. We can choose to live by our values, and we can choose to be grateful for the amazing possibilities that we're given. Over 50 scientific tests have shown us that when large groups of people are peaceful and happy, there is a measurable reduction in violent crime. So every day that you are happy increases the sum total of happiness in the world. And when enough of us live happily by our values, we actually make a real contribution to everyone's happiness. So don't keep your happiness to yourself. Spread it around, and it will make you happier still. There's an old Chinese proverb that I'd like to share with you. If you want happiness for an hour, take a nap. If you want happiness for a day, go dancing. If you want happiness for a year, inherit a fortune. And if you want happiness for a lifetime, help someone else. It's good, isn't it? So we want happiness for all of those things, you know, for an hour. Yeah, we want happiness. So we have those physical things. We have a nap and a nice dinner, and it lasts for as long as it lasts. If we want happiness for a day, something else like dancing or gardening, cooking. But again, it's limited. If you want happiness for a year, inherit a fortune. So they say actually anyone who wins the lotto, by about a year has gone by, they're back to their base level of happiness, what they had before they won lotto, and they're also back to pretty much the same financial circumstances as before they won lotto. So it just lasts a year, unless you prepared for it and invested in some way. If you want happiness for a lifetime, help someone else. So that's the one. That's the kind of happiness that keeps on giving when we, what we bring to the world, when we help others. That's something that we fall back again and again. We can rely on. It makes us feel good and it can grow. So it takes us to the end of our course, folks. Any last questions or comments before we dedicate the merits? Tamara?
Oh, just thank you so much. It's been so wonderful. I've learned so much. I'm sure everybody has feel the same way too. Yeah, it's been excellent. So wonderful.
It's very nice of you to say thank you, Tamara. It's very kind of you to say. I feel like it's been quite an epic course, this one, because so much has happened in the world over these last 6 weeks, you know, not least floods and Ukraine. I mean, you know, as well as just general exhaustion, everyone's personal lives, how they go up and down. And I think it's really extraordinary that we're able to come together and meet like this, you know, each week online. And I think that's a significant thing. It's a really amazing investment in yourselves as human beings. And I really hope it's been beneficial, and I hope to see you next week. Next week is going to be in person in the Gompa as well as online. So, you know, if online is all you can do, I really hope to see you online as well. Let's dedicate. So, again, how we can dedicate the merits is by thinking everything, all the effort that you put into this course, thinking and reflecting, imagine it as an amazing investment in yourself as a human being, and imagine it manifesting as piles of jewels, jewels made of light, really beautiful, and they're all there just piling up in your heart. Each realization, all the effort, everything like that, is just manifesting as piles of jewels, this fortune in your heart that you can call on, that is there as your inner resources whenever you need. And think that that fortune, the more you use it, the greater it will become. And that may we be able to share that, share the joy and the good-heartedness and the effort with everybody to always benefit them. And if we can't benefit them, to at least never harm them. And that way, by changing our behavior just like that, in that very, very simple way, if we continue like that, we'll be able to become liberated and enlightened, and then lead everyone along with us as well, starting from right here and now.